Hello and welcome to another episode of the Ida Playoff Inside Athletics podcast. I'm Ben Harlow and we have another great episode for you today. Today is going to all be about the awards. We've had so much happen since the last episode. For example, the Rising Star nominations have been announced. We've also gone down to the final five for male and female athletes of the year. Go and hit up our social media pages if you haven't seen that already. Along with that, we also have the fan photo contest open again for this year. Now, entries were open way back in the 1st of November, but there is still a chance for you to take part. Entries do close on the 30th of November, so that's this Friday. All you have to do is upload an athletics themed photo taken by you, accompanied with the hashtag IAAF Photo of the Year. That's hashtag IAAF Photo of the Year. Along with all the awards related excitement, I also got the opportunity to catch up with Australian pole vaulting star Curtis Marshall. But before we get into any of that, on today's episode, I've actually got the pleasure of talking all things awards with athlete turned presenter Catherine Merry. So fortunately, I've been joined by this year's presenter of the IAAF Awards, Catherine Merry.
Hello, yes, exciting times ahead.
Yeah, how are you feeling for this year's awards? Literally just around the corner now.
It's a funny one for me because I hosted it last year for the first time and I knew it was a big event because when you're kind of reading an auto cue, you glance to your left and you see Seb and a prince, you think, wow, this is actually quite a big event. And I absolutely loved it. And I don't think I realised though till I actually presented it last year, the magnitude of it. Because everywhere you looked, it was just faces from the world of track and field. So this year, now I know the full extent of what it's all about and how big it is as well and how prestigious it is. I'm really, really looking forward to it, just as I was last year, but with a different angle this year in terms of, okay, now I know what it's about. And then it's like, but who's going to win these awards? And it's a tough one, right? So it's really exciting because you just don't know which way it's going to go.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think this year, it's been such a strong year. We've had three world records on the men's side, which is just incredible. But I want to briefly start off with the Rising Star nominations. Now, since the last podcast has come out, the Rising Stars have been announced. Are there any picks for you of who you're looking for?
Oh, God, you know what? Someone asked me this the other day, just me and my friends were chatting about it in anticipation because they knew I was working on the event. And I said, it's like asking me to choose between my children with these awards. Do you know what I'm saying, Ben? How can you say that one person is potentially better than the other when everybody's just excelled and they're young and they're up and coming and you don't want to dampen anybody's spirit and enthusiasm? But my gosh, if you look at the male rising star in particular, that's a tough one, right?
Yeah.
Because how are you looking at separating Mondo and Jacob?
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It is a real, real tough ask.
Mm-hmm.
And then obviously you add in Jordan as well, Jordan Diaz and the other stuff, let alone Borrega.
Yeah, I
and
know, Borrega.
It is tough. It is so tough. But you know what that shows me is that's healthy and that's brilliant. And look at the standard that we have. You want three or four or five people to be battling out the awards because that shows that you've got depth and quality in the sport at this moment in time. And to have it in the male rising star and then also again in the female rising star, you know, Brianna Williams doing what her coach did back in my World Juniors in 1992 when Williams won both the World Junior titles. And then you got Sydney McLaughlin was just tearing the record book up left, right and centre earlier in the year.
Yep.
It's a tough one again to call.
Yeah, it
and
really
any
is.
Any of them are deserving. That's I think the thing. If anyone, whoever goes on to win it, I don't think you're really going to have many people going, well, that's not fair. Because all of them have got a right in the rising star to obviously be there. And then you've got Mondo Duplantis, who actually, you know, he's popping up in both.
Yeah, I
mean, that's how good he is.
Yeah, well, I think when you look at the rising star, a lot of them can compete at the top level with the senior athletes. I mean, that's why they are rising stars. Like, you know, Sydney McLaughlin also wasn't far off the outright world record over 400-meter hurdles. So
I know. And that's really, and it was good. It's good with the likes of the female one and mentioning Sydney in particular. You know, let's not forget that Carsten Vorholm was the male rising star last year and he won the world title in London and then won the Rising Star Award. So you're right, you know, they're established athletes that just happen to be still really young, which in itself is really, really exciting.
Yeah, I agree. I think the only difference is this year is the Rising Stars have gone to under 20, whereas I think they may have been under 23 last year, so the criteria may have changed slightly. But as you said, Carsten's still only 21, 22. But yeah, all of those men 400 hurdlers at the moment, when you got Samba, Rye Benjamin, they're all so young. So, I mean, that event in itself is, yeah, just really exciting at the moment.
It is. And again, to not repeat myself, but that is what we want. And that's what track and field fans want. And I can tell you that's what athletes want as well. No one wants an easy ride of it. You know, you want to be pushed in your event. You want to go the extra mile when you know your mate's training on Thanksgiving or on Christmas Day. You know, you want to be out there doing it and you want to be pushed. And yeah, the depth that we have in both the male and female Rising Star is just absolutely outstanding. And when you've got, you know, people popping over 6 meters and five in the pole vault and running just under 53 seconds in the hurdles, is senior talent. So God knows which way those are going to go. I really don't have a clue with the Rising Star ones. They're just all too good.
Me, I completely agree. I think a really close one as well for me is the women's category. Now, when it was the top 10, even with the top 10, I didn't know how they'd whittle it down to the final five. But with the final five, we've got Dina Usher-Smith, Shauna Miller-Weibo, Katarina Barguem, Beatrice Jepkowicz, and Nafi Tiam. I mean, what a list.
Yeah. And again, nice, because you're spreading over continents, you're spreading over events, you're going from the short sprints to the longer ones. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, Jepkowicz's, you know, 8-second world record was like, wow.
Phenomenal.
And then you go and look at something like Shauna Miller-Weibo's done, and, you know, the world lead, 400s, everything that she's, what was she, unbeaten?
Yeah, she's unbeaten.
She decided
yeah.
to do in about 15, 16 races.
Yeah, not even just in track events, though. She's actually unbeaten in the high jump and shot put, which she did back in the Bahamas earlier in the year.
I remember, because it was one of those, everyone's going, did I read that right? Did I just see Shauna do a little... do a couple of field events there, but then you balance it, and what Dina did was special,
yeah,
because to win three golds in any continental championships is outstanding, and then the world leads, and Catherine, well, she wins with a golden smile, doesn't she, and she was phenomenal for me this year. I really enjoyed watching, I enjoyed watching everybody, but I think she really did set the field alight this year and the field event. So again, and our defending champion, as it were, athlete of the year, Nafi Tiam,
yep.
You know, world lead and European champion. So, again, you kind of potentially have to just flip a coin and go, you know what, whoever picks this up in Monaco, again, is very, very deserving. And it could be one of those top five quite easily, as we know.
Yeah, I completely agree. On the flip side then, with the men, we've got Mondo reappearing. We've then also got Eliud Kipchoge, marathon world record holder from this year. Abdurrahman Samba, fastest 400-meter hurdles, second fastest, sorry, of all time. Christian Coleman, world record over 60 meters. And then Kevin Mayer, world record in the decathlon. Like, that's mental.
It is. But at least in this men's event, you can kind of, with the greatest of respect, sieve off the ones that didn't do a world record. Isn't that bad? Let's get rid of the two that didn't do a world record, you know, because they're really easy to get, aren't they?
Yeah.
So do you know what I mean? So then you go down, well, Christian Coleman obviously ran his world record indoors, came to Birmingham and smashed it, which I was so pleased about.
Yeah.
He had so much pressure on his shoulders indoors, you know, when his world record initially wasn't ratified, he had to come and do it again and then win in Birmingham.
Yeah.
So he produced some good stuff this year. But if I'm honest, I think the majority of people are seeing it being a two-horse race between what Eliud Kipchoge did with the marathon and what Kevin Mayer did with the decathlon. And that's understandable, because Christian's world record, great, you know, taking it down and lowering it indoors. But what Kipchoge did in the marathon was absolutely outstanding. You know, you take 78 seconds off a world record like that is absolutely immense. And I think quite rightly, with, like I say, with no disrespect to any of the other finalists, I think many do believe it is a two-horse race between Kipchoge and what Kevin did indoors, and then obviously taking Ashton's world record outdoors. They're two phenomenal performances.
Yeah, it's been an amazing year just for the sport in general. I was going to ask you as well, because obviously you're a former athlete, Olympic medalist yourself, and this is considered to be an off year because there's no global major championships, but the standard of competition hasn't dropped. If not, it's maybe even risen a little bit. Do you have any idea why that might be, or?
It's funny, isn't it? Because normally as an athlete, the main criteria is to target that major championships, isn't it? Do you know what I mean? It is that's what you start with on your schedule before you go back into winter training. It's like, okay, what major champs is next year? That's when I have to peak and get it right. And everything else in the season scheduling wise kind of falls around it. So then when you don't have that for some of the athletes in terms of major championships, then it does put their focus onto different things, and it gives them an opportunity maybe to perform and in a different way, because sometimes they're not particularly going for maybe one major thing. So then, and we get peaks and troughs in sport as well, don't we? We look at the events that we have up and down over the years. 5, 6 years ago, the men's shot put on fire. 3, 4 years ago, the men's high jump was just competitive and on fire. And then we just get these peaks and troughs in certain events, don't we? And then the individual athletes that actually do step up and perform. And that's what's happened this year. It's just been a combination of lots of different things, I think, and then the mental attitude of the athlete as well. It is sometimes a little bit different for some athletes when they don't have a major championship, because they are more relaxed in their mind and it's not so serious, because they potentially haven't got so much riding on a major championship season, because it wasn't Worlds and it wasn't Olympics. So then you can just be a little bit more relaxed with what you do, and then a relaxed athlete, produces great performances.
Yeah, I mean, look at Kevin Mayer. He did his world record in front of our home crowd in France at the end of the year. So a perfect opportunity to have a relaxed performance, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. With no real pressure on his shoulders. He'd done his world indoor title in the snow in Birmingham in March. He was majorly fueled by his disappointment at the Europeans, obviously, which is the one blip on his little calendar this year in 2018. And then obviously thought, you know what? Here we go. Like you say, home crowd, backyard, and taking Ashton Eaton's world record. You know what I mean? And that was a tough world record as well. I don't think there's many of us in the sport that would disagree with the way Ashton Eaton left the sport and what kind of shape he left it in. That was a major, major scoop that was for Kevin. And he kind of top and tailed his year. Lovely, didn't he? Just had a little blip in the middle.
Yeah, we won't talk about the middle bit. Anyways, Kath, thank you so much for joining me today. It's been a real help. And yeah, excited to see you out there in Monaco in a few weeks' time.
Oh, looking forward to it. It is always a special night. And yeah, who knows, eh? We've got other awards to give out, of course, for various other people, but the four awards for the actual athletes and their performances. Well, anybody who can call that's a better woman than me.
Also coming up at the Athletics Awards, we're bringing in athletics legends Dawn Harper-Nelson and Greg Rutherford. Both of them retired from the sport this year, but luckily we're not letting them get away just yet, as they're going to be helping us out on awards night too, running around doing red carpet interviews and all sorts of other things. And Dawn especially is really excited for next week.
Hello, my name is Dawn Harper-Nelson, and I'm an Olympic gold and silver medalist, and this year, in 2018, I will have the honor of interviewing some of the best track athletes in the world at the IAAF Athletics Awards Show. This year's nominees have given us quite the show, to say the least. In the male category, it seemed like when each of these men were going to perform, they were going to break the world record. But the crazy thing is, each of them actually did, from Mayer in the decathlon, to Coleman in the 60 meters, to Kipchoge in the marathon. And for the female finalists, the first two names that pop into my head are Asher Smith and Miller Uibo, because they have been setting personal best and dominating competition throughout all of 2018. And the way the world record was smashed in Monaco by Chipkowich, it was just another level. The way she just continued to pull away and dominate that race was just a beautiful sight to see. And Monaco put on an amazing event. And so the ladies in this category throughout their careers have done amazing things, but 2018 has made it very difficult to just know who's going to walk away with this award. So I can't wait for this fun-filled night of just gorgeous athletes stepping outside of their track uniforms and practice clothes and stepping right into their heels, and their suits. So I cannot wait. This is going to be very, very fun.
So coming up next is my interview with Curtis Marshall. Curtis is just genuinely a really good guy, and he's involved in a really exciting generation of pole vaulters. He's only a bit older than the one and only Mondo Duplantis, who's also been on this podcast. You can scroll back down and find the episode where we got to chat to him in Tampere this year. But yeah, as I said, he's part of this golden generation of young pole vaulters, and he's just a really exciting talent, and he gives a brilliant interview. So I hope you guys enjoy.
Tampere.
Oh, cool.
For the World Under 20s. Because you were there in...
Big Gosh.
Yeah, 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
How did you find that?
Yeah, it was good.
Yeah?
It was good. That was my first, like, real good major that I was going in, like, ranked in the top few. So, it was interesting. I'd never, like, gone into something like that ranked high. Because usually it's just like, oh, I'm there to fill the numbers. But then I came and I went in with world lead and I lost my balls.
Oh.
And I screwed up. I only jumped 55, and the
American dude. What was the world lead?
70.
70.
Which is what I cleared. Yeah, and and then the American guy, Deacon Volts, jumped out of his skin to come through. Jumped 14 centimeter PB to beat me.
Wow,
dog. Nah, it's all good though. You live, you learn.
You live and you learn.
We can talk about that a bit if you want.
Can we?
Yeah.
Cool. All right, there. We need
Might
the highs on the lows.
A bit.
You've had a lot of highs recently, so we can touch on the lows. Okay. Anyway, last time I properly spoke to you in person was at 2 a.m. at the Athletics Awards with your mum.
In Monaco.
But you've had, well, quite a lot has changed since then, even from then.
Mm-hmm.
You've had a really big year.
Yep.
And it seems like you and your mum are quite close in terms of...
Very close.
Is she massively into sports as well?
She never really did sports as a youngster,
but
she saw and identified from a young age that I was this kind of kid who had so much energy, and she was just like, this kid needs to get into sport. And in Australia we have Little Athletics, which is like this tiny little branch of athletics, which you can start from a very young age, which I started, which she got me into when I was 6 years of age.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've been doing that my whole life. And because of that, I've been in sport, been involved with sport my whole life. And mum has always just taken to sport. She thought it's a really good way to bring me up, channel all my energy into something instead of being naughty at school and things like that. So she just brought me up in sport. I played Aussie Rules footy for a little bit. But then chose track and field eventually because, you know, I was showing a little bit of promise when I was young, but didn't really start excelling until I started pole vault at about age 13. And it took a while for me to develop that as well. But mum's always been there on my back telling me that, you know, if you can put in the hours of commitment and learn to perfect your craft, then you can take it anywhere. Like, she was always a dedicated student at school, went... had an apprenticeship as a chef, so she knows what it's like to work hard and like work long hours and that sort of stuff and commit to that sort of stuff. So she went down that path and then was like trying to channel what she learned through her apprenticeship into me, into my sport. And I think it's starting to pay off, learning like what it takes to work hard and then reap the rewards, but then also continuing, not just being happy with, you know, one good competition, always like looking for something more to work on, always something, you know, like always finding a better recipe to cook a new dish or like a better technical model to work on and implement in my next jump. So it's really good having mum there because she pushes me hard and she doesn't like to see me down in the dumps or like not training well or things like that. So she's always on my back about, you know, getting the right nutrition in, sleeping lots, and making the right decisions. And she's helped me get to where I am at this point in time, I reckon.
Aww.
Yeah, it's been nice.
So you grew up in Adelaide.
Yes.
Thinking, yeah.
Mm.
How was growing up for you as a kid in Australia?
Easy. I was one of those kids who was not, you know, really socially inclined when I was young. I was always just had so much energy and just loved to be out off running in the playground or like something like that at school. And I pretty much just grew up being the kid that would always play with the soccer ball or find something like a footy ball or like a frisbee to throw at lunch instead of, you know, sitting there in my group chatting. And I had one other really good mate who was pretty similar to me, and we would always go off and like cause lots of mischief at lunchtime and stuff like that, because we had so much energy, and I would never like to just sit down and be bored at mm-hmm. lunchtime. And I it would sometimes carry over into class after lunchtime and like get a bit disruptive, have too much energy. But like eventually I knuckled down into my studies.
Learned how to channel the energy.
Learned how to channel it a little bit. Yeah, a little bit. But yeah, that's where sport helped me out a lot. Mm-hmm. I could sort of distribute my energy to sport and then sort of calm down and then dedicate myself to studies as well. And I think it's really important to have that like work life or like sport study balance.
Yeah.
And I used to suck at it when I was at school, but then coming transitioning into uni, as I grew up a little bit, I learned to get a little bit better at that. But from the younger age, I was just this typical Aussie kid growing up, going through school, having way too much energy and playing sport, loving sport and living it through that. Yeah.
Cool. So where, you said you went to university.
Mm-hmm.
Where did you go to university?
University of South Australia.
Okay.
Which is in Adelaide. And I studied human movement, which is like an exercise science degree.
Cool.
Like all us athletes do. that's all we know. But yeah, hopefully going into a Master of Teaching once I've finished this and becoming like...
When did you finish track?
I finished track, and also when I finished this first degree.
So you're not actually finished yet?
No, I actually finished.
Oh, yeah. How are you finding juggling work and training?
Yeah, it's interesting because, say you have this huge big day of training, and then you know you have to come home and do like study or work or something like that. I come home and I have no motivation. I'm like, ugh, I don't want to study.
Yeah.
But it's all right because my uni is pretty lenient. They allow me to do part-time uni, which is useful, but it means I'm going to take so much longer in the long run. So I've been attending uni for 4 years now, but I've only done 2 years worth of uni. Not even 2 years, but you know, it's I think it's a good distraction from thinking, you know, pover all the time. It's good to sometimes distract yourself with a little bit of study, a little bit of socializing, and a little bit of time away from sport.
What do you do to socialize?
What do I do? Not much.
Typical Australian.
I don't know. Yeah, we, us athletes, I think you probably know Ella Nelson, Morgan, all those guys. We all just like to hang at cafes. We
drink nice coffee.
Drink coffee.
That like soup bowl of coffee that they see you drink.
That's actually iconic of Adelaide, yeah.
How do you drink it, though?
Bowl of coffee. I'm surprised you noticed because, that's classic. It's travelled all the way across the world, obviously. But yeah, in Adelaide, you can go to this place on the beach, you can buy a bowl of coffee, and I always just get, you know, a large flat white, and it takes me like an hour to get through it because it's like eating lunch.
Okay, so you said that around 13, you got into pole vault for the first time.
Yep.
When did you realise that, I'm actually quite good at this?
Yeah, well, it took a while. Pole vaulting is one of those events where you're not really born with it, and you have to work hard at it, and you have to embed the technique into your body so much so that you then, you know, relearn how to run without using your arms but with a pole in your hands. So like it takes a long time to learn how to do that, and it took me a few years, but then I sort of started gradually seeing a little bit of success in Australia. I went to national championships a few times, came away with a bronze medal or a silver medal, and then eventually when I got to about 16 years of age, I was the younger age for the World Junior Championships in 2014 in Oregon.
Yeah.
And I qualified by jumping 5.05.
Nice.
And I was only the second Australian to jump 5 meters at age 16. So I was like, ooh, I'm onto something here. Maybe I can pursue a career in pole vaulting. And it qualified me for the World Juniors. I went to World Juniors, was way out of my depth.
Was that your first international?
First international comp, yeah, as well. So I was like,
how did you find that being abroad with all these different nations?
It was crazy. I was just lucky it was in an English speaking country, so that was so lucky. But what I learned from that was not only having the privilege of wearing the green and gold Australian bib, but having all your friends and family behind you when you're competing and doing something that you love, and you feel like this big sense of accomplishment when you get to represent your country on that level, because you've put in a certain amount of hours to dedicate yourself to your craft, but then you don't really get any recognition until you do something at a big scale, yeah, right, on a big level. And that was my first taste of that big scale kind of thing at the World Junior Championships. And I didn't do great, but
where did you go?
I came like 15th or something, didn't quite make the final.
I have you down for 10th. I don't know whether that was 10th in qualifying or something. I don't know.
I probably equal 10th, equal 10th, yeah, I reckon, okay, because they take 12 through. But I reckon like 5 of us all jumped the height before,
yeah, okay,
before getting in. But no, nah, that's all right. It was a good experience, and I learned a lot from it that,
yeah,
I could take into the future.
Yeah, age 16 as well. Mm. Not many people can say they did that.
Yeah, going to the early World Juniors was probably the stepping stone in my career that made me realise, like, look, I could make a career out of this. Mm-hmm. So I was happy that I had that experience and I can take it into future competitions.
Yeah.
Which is really good.
So following on from that, I guess, 2015... How did your PB progress?
I went from 5:05 qualifying for World Juniors to 5:42.
Wow.
Which is a pretty big progression in that year. But that was a year where I had a little bit of a mental case. I would go into every single competition in Australia ranked like first.
Yeah.
But I would always find a way to lose somehow. Because I was in this mental state thinking that, you know, oh, I'm pretty good at this. I've got this covered. I don't have to worry about anything. And I'll jump a PB easily. Because at that young age, you think you're invincible. But I was trying to control things that were out of my control, like my other competitors or the crowd or the wind or things like that.
How would you try and control them?
I would always just focus on them and forget my processes and forget what I actually need to do to jump a bar. And because you're still so young and it's not quite embedded yet, you can't think about anything else other than yourself.
Yeah.
You can go out there and enjoy yourself, but I wasn't enjoying myself that year, 2015, because it took me so long to gather my confidence to win a competition. It took me until 2016 to get that confidence back, because I saw a sports psychologist to help me through it.
Yeah.
Gave me some cues about how to control the controllables, things like that, which was difficult for me at the time, because I thought, you know, like, I've got this covered, like, I'm 5:40 jumper, that's so cool. But in the scheme of things, it's not like very big at the time.
I don't know. Still,
it was alright, but
A17, pretty good.
Not too bad. Not too, well, compare myself to Mondo, man. Like, he's jumping like 6 meters at 18. Not quite. But.
Okay, he's ridiculous. He's another beast entirely. But he was. I've always found with pole vaulters, I feel like if there's any event that mentally can be your biggest enemy, is the pole vault.
100%.
They saw it with Steve Hooker.
Yeah.
How he really struggled.
Exactly. Well, that's a like key thing in my motivation kind of thing for whenever I'm going through tough times.
Mm-hmm.
I just know that Steve Hooker went through his career. He went through this period of 18 months where he wasn't even taking off the ground. He couldn't gather the mental strength to hold onto the pole, even off like more than 2 steps. Like, it was terrible for him. And I know that if I ever go through hardships, I can just think back to like when Steve didn't take off for 18 months. I'm like, this is nothing compared to that. So it's really cool to have people like that I can look back on and reflect and learn from, because pole vaulting's not easy mentally.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's really good to learn from all the past heroes of the sport and how they dealt with it. And channel that into my pole vaulting in the future.
I've been told as well that you and Steve talk regularly about your own pole vaulting and other stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about that a little bit more. How cool is it to have an Olympic champion?
So cool. He he's one of those guys who's done everything in terms of this sport. And to be able to talk to him about the smallest things that I would think nothing of, but he really thinks a lot of, like changing slight little tweaks in my technique, or like how to approach different competitions in Europe, how to approach the travel aspect, because coming from Australia, it's quite a big part for us, because in Europe, lots of the guys can just, you know, hop in a car, 3 hours are at the next meet, whereas in Australia, you have to really work it out and plan in advance, and because it's like 24 hours for us to get to Europe and back. Learning from him and learning from his experiences has been really valuable for me. We text all the time, and I send him some of my training vaults, and he gives me a bit of advice on my technique and stuff, which is pretty cool. But he also gives me advice on how to deal with, you know, the pressures of the big competitions like this, like a Diamond League event or like World Championships. And, you know, he's been in my shoes before, going in ranked, you know, like middle of the field back back before he won the Olympics and stuff. But he gave me tips on how to approach competitions and how to make the most out of certain environments and certain situations that you find yourself in. I was lucky enough to sign with his same manager, Stefan Kyle. So we have a connection there, and Stefan's been really good and telling me stories about how Steve used to love living on circuit and all the mischief they used to get up to and that sort of stuff, which is really cool, because I thought once you get to Europe, it's like game time. But it can be a little bit of fun if you
are young. So
exactly. So yeah, I'm very much looking forward to keeping in contact with him and progressing my career and hopefully filling his shoes or creating my own shoes one day.
Exactly. Okay, so 2015 you progressed again.
Yep.
You struggled a little bit mentally, but 2016 you got your first win back again.
Yeah.
You also that year had the World Under-20s again, but this time as an 18-year-old.
Yes, this time I was the older age, which is really good. But going into the 2016 season, my confidence was back, all this sort of stuff was back, and I was winning competitions in Australia, and I was getting my head back into gear. Mm-hmm. And I went from 542 to 555 in Australia, and that was really exciting because I think it was like the top 10 pole vaults in Australia, top 10 highest jump in Australia ever, which was pretty cool at the time. And I thought, well, this is pretty damn good. It qualified me for the World Junior Championships, and I was like, damn, that's only 15 centimetres off the Olympic qual this year. And I was like, cool.
Ever on your periphery at the start of that year?
Oh, no. A little bit. Knowing World Juniors was the same year, that was definitely my priority.
Yeah.
I wanted to go there and compete to the best of my ability. And because, you know, further down the track, you can then be known as World Junior Champion 2016. I didn't want to dedicate my focus to the Olympic Games because it was such a far-fetched reach.
Yeah.
But, you know, eventually, I trained hard for the block between the Australian summer ending and the European summer starting. And we're at a comp in Mannheim in Germany.
The gala thing.
Junior Gala.
Yeah, you were there as well recently.
I went a week ago, And it's a pretty good track to pole vault. So we like to start there each year.
Yeah.
Just to get like a low caliber meet under our belt before we start with big meets like this. Went there with the intention of probably just jumping a PB, and I ended up clearing 550 first attempt, 560 first attempt, which was a PB at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And then we were like, let's not muck around and go 65, why not give 70 a crack? I was on the biggest pole I've ever been on. The whole World Junior team was there cheering me on, the whole stadium was there cheering me on, and I was like, why not give this a crack? And I cleared 570 third attempt, which was unbelievable. Like, probably the best moment of my life still till this day. And, it qualified me for Rio. I think it was, like, a week before the cutoff date, which was so perfect. Then went on to World Junior Championships. Got a little bit of a big head. Thought I was top.
You had the world lead.
I was.
So you had a reason to get into it like that.
Exactly. But I think that was a little bit to my detriment.
Mm-hmm.
I went into the World Juniors thinking that I was the best, and I'm not even really regarding any of my competitors as even close to being able to knock me off. And then it came competition, and the qualifying round went good, cleared 35 to get into the final, which was pretty easy. And then came competition day, and I was really confident, body was feeling really good, and I went through with a clean sheet up until 55, and I think I was in the lead at this point, and no one else had cleared 55, and there was only one guy left to attempt 55, and it was Deacon Volz from America, and he passed his third attempt at 55 to take the lead at 60, and he cleared first attempt, which was already, I think, like a 12 centimeter PB for him. And then, so I was like, oh, all right, game is on. So I then took three attempts at 560 and missed. And then he went on to jump 65, which was a 17 centimeter PB for him. And so he was obviously the better jumper on the day, and I thought I had it won at 55. But I learned from that competition that that it's never over until, like, the last guy in the competition doesn't have any more jumps left.
Yeah.
If anyone in the competition still has one jump, you can't disregard them. Mm-hmm. And I learned that, and I took that into the rest of my career, and it's proved to be a very valuable lesson, because I think the best way to learn is to by making mistakes and, like, by learning from them. And yeah, and then you can take that into the rest of your career, knowing that you've been through situations that you're experiencing at the time, and you're able to channel them and remember, like, oh, this guy's still got to jump, even though I don't think he's going to clear the bar. You still have to be on your toes, ready to jump the next bar. And yeah, so I thought that was very valuable.
It was a really valuable comp for you.
Yeah.
But then in the back of your mind, you knew your season wasn't over.
Yeah.
You were heading to Rio.
Yeah, but then after the World Juniors, I think it was just like this just huge, big hype of fun after that. Look, it's hard to then get yourself back up after a major.
Mm-hmm.
I know a lot of the guys do it in Europe each year, but my major for that year was the World Juniors, and then Rio was just a bonus. And it happened to be 3 weeks later, totally different continent, different part of the world, and I stayed away from home for like 2 months before that. Yeah. So that was the biggest trip of my life so far. It was pretty tough living on the road for so long, eating foreign foods and staying out of routine so much.
Yeah.
So it was tough to get myself back up for Rio, but I think just the pure adrenaline of the competition and the pure scale of it, and getting to represent my country on that scale, picked me back up, and I was able to jump decent, jump 560 in the qualifying round, which was better than what I jumped in the World Juniors. But in the scheme of things, didn't qualify me for the final, and wasn't really good enough on the day, but considering I was such a youngster, and it was like my first experience jumping at that level, I was very grateful that I had that opportunity, because I met guys like Sam Kendricks and Reno and all those guys who I'm seeing weekly now on the circuit, which is so cool, and breaking through that barrier and making my first major open championship like that was a really valuable experience.
Yeah.
And I'm very grateful that I got to have that, because it sort of set me up for my future to come.
Well, yeah, I mean, you didn't quite make the final in Rio, but you still jumped well, and then taking that momentum for London 2017, how did you approach that, your first World Championship?
Yeah, first World Championships where I wasn't going in just to fill the numbers. Yeah. I was there to make the final, and I was there to jump big. I went into it, only improved my personal best from 570 to 573, but I jumped 570 eight times that year before the World Championships. So my consistency was up.
Mm-hmm.
And I could pretty well back myself in and jump 570 any day of the week. And I knew that going into the World Championships that I would have to do that to make the final.
Mm-hmm.
Luckily enough, I cleared 560 first attempt. And that got me into the final at World Championships. But having the experience of Rio and then a few Diamond Leagues under my belt before that helped me calm my nerves a little bit, because before Rio, I was just like this nervous wreck. I could not even handle myself. I can barely remember the experience, because it was so mentally tough to get through the fact that I wasn't just competing against these guys that I was watching on TV. They were like my rivals. They were there to beat me. And I was like, what? These guys are all my idols. I can't even fathom competing against them. But I'm glad I had that experience, because come London, I kind of felt a part of it again, which was really cool. And knowing that I'm a part of such an elite group like that, and being able to come away a World Championship finalist was really awesome, meant the world to me. And it's a really good stepping stone again for the rest of my career. And going from just making Rio to then finalist to then seeing what we can do from there was pretty exciting. So I was very happy with that.
Well, you were seventh in London.
Yep.
And then a few months later, you went back to the UK again.
Yep.
For the World Indoors this year.
Yes.
I mean, that was, as a performance in itself,
that
was an incredible meeting. Just for pole vault in general, was on a massive high at that point in time. There was like 10, 12 of you all jumping 570, 580, if not higher.
Yep.
And especially what was most interesting is the crop of young guys and you, Mondo, Manuel Corrales, was just such an exciting competition. Mm. I remember, like, as in the stands, when you, well, in fact, you tell a story. Tell us it from your point of view.
Yeah, it was crazy because I didn't really think about the World Indoor Championships being a thing, like, at all. But then when I showed up, it turned out to be, like, one of the biggest comps that I've ever been at. Mm-hmm. And I was like, what? What is this? What is this indoor thing?
I never indoors, jumped. Yeah, for Australians, not really a thing.
Never jumped indoors. And I was like, but when I showed up, everyone was there and everyone was there to win. And it was exactly the same as the World Championships last year. And I thought, whoa, this is game time here. Everyone wants to win. This is going to be a big competition. And there were a few of us. Actually, I think the meet before in Clermont-Ferrand, like eight guys jumped 5.88.
Yeah.
So I was like, oh God, I'm going to have to jump big here if I want to do something. And so the atmosphere was awesome and everyone was going in pretty confident because they jumped huge the week before. And so straight final at the World Indoors. So we all just went out there, took our bars easily as the competition started. And I think everyone was clearing bars that they were expected to. And then it came to about 5.80. Mm-hmm. And that's usually about the deciding height of any competition. And it threw, it rattled a fair few of the guys.
It rattled a fair few of the big guys.
Fair few of the big guys, which I was pretty, like, surprised to see.
And, yeah, the people who handled it the best are actually...
Sometimes, it like, major championships can throw people. So yeah. I managed to clear 5.80 first attempt, which was an equal PB at the time. Cleared it alongside Emmanuel Corrales. The two youngsters took the step up, jumped 5.80. And then it had to take Sam and Piotr and Renault 85 to then beat us to get into the lead. Because we were in the lead at that point, clearing 80 first attempt. No one else cleared first attempt. And then so the other guys had to then clear the next height. And unfortunately, Mondo went out at 85 as well. But yeah, came away with fourth place at the World Indoor Championships, which is the biggest thing that I've achieved in my life so far, up until that point. And I thought that was pretty phenomenal and really good experience again to then be fighting for the medals, which I've never done before, which was a very valuable experience come the next month after that.
How did that feel though when you cleared 5.80 and you were like, oh my God, I could actually win this thing right now? Did that cross your mind before the comp?
I didn't think that I could actually win this thing because I thought I could jump a personal best and then that would put me in the medal range.
What's 5.80 a PB?
5.80 was equal PB.
Equal PB, okay.
And I would have liked to have jumped 85, which would have been a lifetime best.
Yeah.
But I knew the caliber of the guys out there. If they weren't jumping 5.80, it was a bad day for them. So I was expecting everyone to jump like 85, 90. And it turned out only three guys did.
Yeah.
And it put me fourth. And I was like, whoa. I cleared 5.80. And then the next intention was to go 85. And I missed first two attempts at 85. So then we went 90. And 90 was like the biggest bar I've ever seen in my whole life. I was like, that is huge. There's no way I'm getting over it. Turned out I didn't get over it. But it took 5.90 to win World Indoors. And it took a guy like Renaud Lavillenie to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought to myself after that competition, wow, I'm attempting the same bars that these heroes of my event are attempting.
World record holders
are attempting. I'm like, well, I'm in this game now. This is real. I can seriously mix it with the guys. And that was a really... really top experience for me because I thought it would take a lot longer to get to that point. And now that I'm a consistent 5.80 jumper, I think the next step is then to, you know, push for that podium spot. I've never actually come third at come on the podium at a open, you know, major championship like that. So I think that's the next step for me, definitely.
Well, you kind of got there a month later.
Kind of.
Talk to me about, I mean, people who listen to this podcast may not know an awful lot about the Commonwealth Games.
Mm.
So explain a little bit.
Commonwealth Games is like the, I'd say, next big thing after the Olympic Games, World Championship, and then it comes Commonwealth Games for, I don't know, in the scheme of track and field things.
Yeah.
It's not the highest caliber event there is in the world, but if your country is in it, you mean business. And so because it was on home soil in Australia this year, it was like the biggest thing that's ever happened in Australian track and field. So everyone was hyping it up. Everyone thought it was going to be like the biggest thing on Australian soil in years. And it turned out to be a pretty good games. And going into that with the experiences of Rio and of World Champs in 2017 and World Indoors, I thought, you know, this isn't going to be anything compared to that. But then came competition day, and I was the most nervous person I think I've ever met. I've never seen myself like that, and I think it's just because it was on home soil. It was in front of all my family and friends.
You were the favorite,
and I was the I was top two favorite. Me and Sean were battling for first, because Sean, he put up a fight. He jumped 93, I think, the week or 2 weeks before in Texas, and I was like, whoa, here we go. This is going to be the biggest competition ever. So I was nervous, thinking that I had a lot of pressure riding on my shoulders to beat this guy and to do my country proud. And it was quite tough to get over that and then refocus and center and control the controllables and control my processes and all that sort of stuff come competition. But it's a pretty big thing in the scheme of Australian athletics. And I thought of it as a really good opportunity for me to get my name out there, everyone to sort of recognize that I'm not just, you know, following in the shadow of Steve Hooker. I'm like my own athlete now, kind of thing. And I ended up, doing all right. Came away with the gold medal.
More than all right.
And I was so stoked that I managed to get my processes down pat by the end of the competition and cleared 570, third attempt to win it. It was probably the most ecstatic feeling I've ever had. Whatever happens, happens. Like, I can't control my celebrations, really.
Yeah.
You can't plan it like Usain Bolt. You know, he always does that one. I don't plan it. I just, whatever comes through my body at the time.
At that point, was if you got that jump, you'd won it. Was that it?
Yeah. In pole vault, if you miss a few bars, it goes, so count back works that if I miss the height before, on if I clear it on second attempt, I've got one miss, and then say Sean and I both cleared 570 third attempt, it would go to the height before. I cleared it second attempt. If he cleared it second attempt, we'd be equal, and then it would go total amount of misses before that.
So in that situation,
it wouldn't then go the height before. So in that situation, we were both equal.
Yeah.
If I didn't clear 570, it would have gone to a jump off. And I knew that. A lot of people didn't know it, but I knew it at the time, and I was like, all right, good opportunity to jump 570. So so let's go and get this. And I ended up channeling the whole crowd and managed to do it the best of my ability, and came away with a good jump, and I was very happy with it.
After that competition for you, was it just relief or?
Well, after the Commonwealth Games win, I was like so relieved, because going into the competition, I didn't give myself an opportunity. I didn't even think that I would come second. I didn't even consider the option of coming second, because it was going to be such a big thing for me and for my country to win that thing. And it was going to be a very good stepping stone for me, knowing that it's a big competition. Mm-hmm. It's not the biggest, but it's a big competition, and it's quite meaningful in the scheme of track and field things. And I was very happy that I came away with the win, and it meant a lot to me, because Steve Hooker and I were talking about it before, and he was like, this is a very good opportunity for you to finally break through and win your first international gold medal. Because he did exactly the same thing in Melbourne in 2006. And our stories are quite similar, in fact. So he won the Commonwealth Games in 2006 with a jump of 580. I won it with 570 and attempted 580. But then we both sort of had the same idea of that we needed to change something up. And he moved from Mark Stewart to Alex Parnov. And I did exactly the same thing. I moved from Kim Simons to Alex Parnov.
That's an iconic Commonwealth Games training group, though.
It's very iconic, because Alex's coach, 3 6-meter vaulters, a world record holder, multiple world champion, Olympic champions and everything. And I was like, that's the best resume you could ask for as a coach. So why not take this leap of faith? And it may take me out of my comfort zone for a little bit, moving to a different coach, but like, what better way is there to live? You can't really not take the opportunities and not take those leaps of faith mm-hmm. when you think that that might be the best thing for you. And you'll never know if you don't take them. So I decided to take that leap after the Commonwealth Games, and it's been pretty good since then. And now I'm excited to come up against the big boys here in Paris, and see what the training is going to be like out on the competition field.
What height are you aiming for this summer? What's the future saying?
Well, I current personal best 580, and I would like to obviously jump a PB each season. That would be nice. A few of the guys are jumping very big this season, and younger guys are jumping higher than me, which kind of sucks. So I have to.
You can hear Mondo in the background. <didn't you?
laughs> I have to hold my own ground. So it would just be good to jump a personal best, and whatever the personal best that may be, that would be good. But I think, you know, I definitely have an extra 10 centimetres in me, and whatever that places me in the world, I'll be pretty happy. So yeah, looking forward to a good competition.
Also, well, best of luck.
Cheers, Chris, dude.
And thank you for chatting.
No worries at all.
Okay, so Mondo has very kindly joined Curtis and I to play a little bit of a pole vault quiz trivia game. There's already been some fighting talk amongst them both as well. Mondo, do you want to say hey?
Hey, what's up?
Always really enthusiastic. Love
always.
It.
Always.
You're
too
okay.
Fun.
Yeah.
Is this your
hello?
Dad?
I gotta go, Dad. I'm doing something. Interview stuff.
I want to be... shorter than this
guy. Me, yeah. In my back as well.
How tall are you both? You're a giant, Curtis.
Nah, 91. 191. What are you?
Really?
88. Nah, 88.
Your face.
You're tall? I don't think you got your numbers right.
Yeah.
I'm like 83, maybe. At most, maybe 82.
Yeah, I think I'm about 183. I'm just on the
Yeah, you're a giant compared to me.
Yeah, you are tall.
You look tall on the field. I'm like, yeah.
Big okay. Boy Mondo.
Okay, so guys, pole vault trivia quiz question time. The boys have both got their buzzers. Mondo.
Caddy.
Curtis.
Ding!
Okay, alright, so pole vault question time. Okay, so question number one. What year was the men's pole vault introduced into the Athletics World Championships?
World Championships, not Olympics.
What about this? Do you know if it was after the Olympics or before? Or you don't know?
After, surely.
I guess.
Ding, ding, ding! I reckon it's 76, 1976. Earlier?
Oh.
Later. Over to Mondo.
Later. Oh, it's on you now.
Got him, but don't really got it. 1980...
Yeah.
One.
Oh, 2 years out. 83.
Oh, okay.
Okay, so 0.
So I was wondering, because I knew 80 was Olympic year, so I was thinking it would be... Ah, shit.
Okay, next question. Okay. When was the pole vault introduced for the women? To the World Championship?
Ding, ding, ding.
1999. Yes. 1-0 to go.
Well, if you just said Olympics, I'd have said 2000. Because it was 2000.
Right? It was 2000 for the Olympics, yeah.
Okay. How many back-to-back world titles did Sergei Bubka have?
I'll say, got him, seven?
Yeah, it sounds about right.
Eight?
Six.
Oh!
I know he had it.
Six.
Well, you said, you said it. You said six.
I said six.
You said it. I said Curtis. It's
Curtis!
Like, oh, six!
Alright, there we go to the point for that one. Okay, next question. Okay. Who took the men's world title in 2015?
Ding ding ding, Sean Barber!
Yeah,
my roommate.
2-0 to Curtis. Okay.
Sorry, mate, too slow.
Who took the women's world title in 2017?
Sabinini.
Yeah. Ah. Okay, 2-1 with the response. Okay, which Cuban has won a medal in the last three world championships?
Gadin Lazaro Borges?
Nah, man.
Gadin
Silva.
Lissi Silva. I started the word first,
know.
I'm pretty sure.
Yaroslav
Da
Silva.
Wait.
Man, she's a good pole vaulter.
Oh, that's true, because it was 2011.
Yeah, he...
When he it was 2011 he finished, when he got
second. Okay, because Mondo got started first, you'll get the point, but Curtis, if you can name what medals she got, then you get a bonus point.
In the last three.
The last three World Championships, she's got a medal in every single one.
Man, she hasn't won. So, let me go... I don't think... Let me go two bronze and a silver.
Close. Two bronze and a gold.
Oh! She won! You didn't know she won? She won?
Yeah, she won.
She won in Beijing.
She won. 2015! She used to be...
Nobody
killer.
Beat her.
She was killer back then.
Mm.
Not back then. Damn. She's still good.
Next.
Okay, next question. Okay. Which city did both you guys win a medal at the World Under 20s?
Ding ding. Bydgoszcz.
Oh no!
I'm doing this! Got him! Got him! Bydgoszcz.
Bydgoszcz. Yeah, he won that. He got it.
But you beat me there.
Sure.
Okay.
Hold on to that.
Sure.
Okay, bonus question. Can either of you spell it?
Scotty B?
Yeah.
Y? That's right already.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, B Y D?
Yeah.
G?
Mm-hmm.
E?
No.
Ding ding. B Y D G?
Mm-hmm.
O?
Mm-hmm.
S Z C Z?
Yes! How did you do that? Nice work.
I remember, because it was not a great championship for me.
Yeah, second. I got third.
Mm.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. And he went into the meet as like the big favorite.
Yeah. I know, I discussed this earlier. Not my best competition.
Were you scared of him?
Me?
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
He was, I mean, but he was much better than me, at that point, so it wasn't like...
Yeah.
It wasn't like I wasn't supposed to be here.
Yeah, I saw the podium photo of you guys with the American, and you both look so different. I mean, obviously it was 2 years. Wow.
Puberty.
I jumped 45, and that was like a big jump.
Yeah, it was good.
Was a big jump for me. Last attempt, remember?
Really?
Yeah, last attempt. I'd have got like sixth or seventh.
We were shitting bricks for you, man. Yeah, I remember.
It was a big jump.
So unfortunately, that is all we have time for on today's IAAF Inside Athletics podcast. I'm Ben Harlow, and you can find me on social media at _BenHarlow. Along with that, you can follow us on all of our social media channels. That's IAAF_athletics on Instagram, IAAF.org on Twitter, and the World Athletics Club on Facebook. Also, it shouldn't be long till you hear from us again, as we'll be bringing you an awards-based special next week. Anyways, I hope you guys enjoyed this week's episode, and I'll speak to you next week.